Dan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us on the line Chris Emery, and we're going to be talking about the Oklahoma City bombing. Now, a lot of people are going to say, well, why worry about that? I mean, that was a long time ago. That was April 1995. Why are you worried about the bombing today? I mean, shouldn't we be worried about modern things, about the war, and about the economy and what's happening to society? And, well, it was, of course, George Santayana, who said, those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it. And if we don't understand what really happened that morning in Oklahoma City, and why it was that 168 Americans died, and incidentally there was no effort on the part of the government to give all the families $500,000 or $1 million or $2 million for the people who were lost there, well, what's the difference between Oklahoma City and what happened in New York on September 11th? Why is one group being so well compensated and the other group not? And the reason that they're, of course, giving so much money to the people in New York is they have to promise not to sue, not to bring any, participate in any other lawsuits, you see. And, of course, the people in Oklahoma City don't know who they can sue, but certainly the people in New York could sue the people who built the buildings, or they could sue the people who owned the buildings, or they could sue the airline company, or they could sue the Saudi Arabians because they were financing so much of the whole Islamic terrorist movement. And that's the last thing that the government wants, because then there'd be discovery. And the American people might find the truth of what happened on September 11th. The one thing we do know is we haven't been told the truth. And how do we know that? Simply the story of the two passports. One that survived the bombing of the North Tower. The other that survived the plane going down in Pennsylvania. We know that somebody knew who was going to be on those planes ahead of time and planted those passports. There's no way that two passports could have survived the flaming infernos of those flaming crashes. Those passports were planted by their impact on the American people, and the people behind this really weren't that smart. They didn't have to do it. We have pictures of the passports, at least one of the passports. It was up on the FBI website. They finally took it down after a couple of days. They figured maybe the American people would be smart enough to say, how could those passports have survived? And if the government lied about anything, they're lying about everything. That's the tragedy. And so Let's go back and look and see what happened in Oklahoma City, because perhaps if we understood Oklahoma City and the fact that they lied about Oklahoma City to this very date, why the FBI refuses to release the videotapes that were taken outside the Murrah Building on the morning of April 19, 1995, because of an ongoing investigation? Of an ongoing investigation? Our guest is Chris Emery. Hi, Chris. How are you doing?
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Why don't you give our listeners just a little bit about your background and how you got involved in this quest for truth?
I was a former investigative reporter for a major media outlet for approximately 8 years on a part-time basis, and then I started doing investigative work with the TWA case. A good friend of mine, Jerry Longspaugh from Fort Worth, Texas, had approached me in early 2000 with some of the unedited raw footage from the Oklahoma City case, and he asked me to look at it. And he has since put together, at that time, he put together the Oklahoma cover-up in Oklahoma.
Now we do carry that.
Yes, very listening. Good tape.
And, hold that thought here for just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan here. Our guest is Chris Emery, and we're talking about what happened in Oklahoma City and how it was that Chris got involved in this whole investigation. Go ahead, pick up the story there, Chris.
Sure. The footage that I was viewing on Jerry's tape simply didn't add up to the official story that I had heard in the previous 4 years. And so I thought, okay, I'm going to help Jerry out and his colleagues and look into this case a little further. And 6 months and $8,000 later, I realized that we were being bald-faced lied to by the Justice Department. Nothing about the case was adding up. And the more and more I looked at it, the more and more I realized that there needed to be more work done. I had approached former State Representative Charles Key here in Oklahoma City, and I was living in Dallas at the time, and commuted up over a dozen times within about a two-year period, and finally decided to relocate here. And I couldn't think of anything I'd be wanting to do right now. I'm very proud to work with these people, and we're still continuing on for the quest for the entire truth on this case.
And, of course, the question is, not was Timothy McVeigh guilty. I believe he was guilty. I believe that he was intimately involved in what went on. But there were other people involved as well, and the government is covering for them. And the question has to be, why is the government covering for John Doe 1 and John Doe 2 and John Doe 3 and John Doe 4? Why did Timothy McVeigh admit that he wrote this book? Those of you who've read it, written by a couple of reporters from a Buffalo newspaper, and is admitting he bombed the building all by himself. And as you read his discussion of what happened, you know that he's lying. I mean, if you read the book, it's the most amazing thing. Timothy McVeigh's driving through the streets of Oklahoma City on the morning of the 19th of April. He has two fuses to this massive bomb in the back of his truck. One's a five-minute fuse, and one is a one-minute fuse. So 5 minutes he's driving through the streets. He lights the five-minute fuse when he thinks he's about 5 minutes from the building. Then when he gets about 1 minute away from the building, he lights the one-minute fuse. And he's still a block or so away. He doesn't know whether there's going to be a parking place in front of the building. He doesn't know that there could be a traffic jam. And now he's got both of those fuses burning back towards this massive explosion. Do you honestly believe that he would do that? He parks the truck, and then he calmly walks across the street. But how did he have time? By this time, he would have had 20 or 30 seconds by the time he got the car parked. How long does it take you to park your car? Read that book, and you realize, of course, that the whole thing is a lie. It's contrived for one purpose, and that is to convince you Timothy McVeigh carried out the bombing essentially alone. But, of course, he wasn't alone. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Chris Emery, and he's been investigating the Oklahoma City bombing for, I guess, since about 1999 now?
Yes, sir. Late 99, and I joined with the Oklahoma Bombing Investigation Committee in June of 2001. And I relocated here to Oklahoma City in early of 2003 to work on a manuscript and a screenplay for a film documentary on the case.
All right, fine. Well, tell us, what have you actually learned? In other words, what have we learned that isn't true? And why don't you accept the official government position that Timothy McVeigh, acting alone, well, maybe with a little help from Terry Nichols, planned and plotted and carried out this massive bombing?
Physically, financially, and mentally, it would have been absolutely impossible for Mr. McVeigh and Mr. Nichols to carry this off by themselves. As we all know, Terry Nichols was in Harrington, Kansas, repairing the roof on his home at the time of the bombing, so obviously he couldn't be two places at once. We do have credible witnesses and irrefutable evidence to show that there were at least four other people at the scene of the crime.
Closing the door and getting a glass of water.
And we went ahead and interviewed additional witnesses, 23 of them that were very credible, showing that there were as many as six others at the scene, in addition to Mr. McVeigh, and six in addition to that that were serving on a secondary basis, some of whom were informants for the United States government that failed to share and act upon the prior knowledge of the bombing as early as December of 1994.
Well, now, of course, is there any way any of those informants will admit to their involvement and, of course, bring this truth out to the American people?
Well, Carol Howe actually was a good informant, and she did admit that she had the information, and of course her handler from the FBI, Angela Finley, documented as much. She was put on trial and threatened to have, because she was alleged bomb-making material in her home, and it was actually material that the ATF and the FBI gave her. So she was one of the good informants that actually did try to act upon it and was shut down by the ATF and the FBI.
For our listeners out there, Carol Howe came from a very wealthy family in the Oklahoma area, and a disillusioned, mixed-up young lady. But eventually she had some sort of affair with somebody from Elohim City, and eventually volunteered to become an informant for the BATF. And she had told the BATF that they were planning on blowing up the Murrah Building. And to silence her, to keep Carol Howe from testifying at the Timothy McVeigh trial, why the federal government indicted this naive young woman, mm-hmm. who had risked her life thinking she was doing something patriotic to help preserve America. They indicted her, and they were quite willing to send her to prison for the rest of her life as a terrorist, knowing full well that she was actually a government informant. And had it not been for the fact that her family had a great deal of money, was actually able to hire an attorney named Clark Brewster to defend her, right. She would be an innocent woman in prison today, put there to silence her, to keep the American people from knowing the truth. And if you'd like to hear my interview with Clark Brewster, we have that in our four-tape set, the Oklahoma City Update. I don't know if anybody else has ever interviewed Clark Brewster, but it was a fascinating, as we find out, that Carol Howe had gone to a place called Elohim City. There was a Christian identity center. And if you've ever read any of the FBI reports back in the 1990s, Christian Identity was one of those terrible anti-government organizations, right-wing terrorist groups that were a threat to the survival of America. The only trouble was that the head of the group, Reverend Millar, was an FBI informant. In fact, from what I've been able to understand, an awful lot of the people there were working for one or another for a part of the government. But the American people have never been allowed to realize that this whole radical movement, which was such a threat to America, was actually being financed by various branches of our government. What did you find out about Elohim City when you began investigating it? What did you find out about Carol Howe?
Well, Ms. Howe was actually, you hit it right on the head, Stan, and it's good that you did interview Attorney Brewster. He's one of the best in the country, and you're right. Ms. Howe was very fortunate to be able to retain his services. He, in no uncertain terms, presented all of the information to show that the government did set her up for the fall. And luckily, the jury saw through that and acquitted her of all charges leveled against her by the prosecution. And very fortunate. In fact, I've met the judge. He's now a practicing private practice attorney here in Oklahoma. And he laid it out and what had happened. And luckily, he was impartial and allowed the evidence to be presented.
Unlike the attorney in the McVeigh case, who would not allow any of the really important issues to be addressed, including Carol Howe's testimony.
That's correct. It was amazing. The judge not only shut out her testimony, but the 33-page scathing report from the Inspector General's office showing that the federal prosecution for both the McVeigh and the Nichols trial withheld evidence to show that their evidence, their physical evidence regarding the bomb making, the blast analysis, and the overall damage to the Murrah building was completely bogus.
There were charges on those pillars, weren't there?
That's correct.
That's what took the building down, not the external bomb.
According to what we have, and this is information not only supplied to us by our private investigators, the bombing committee hired, but through law enforcement for the local, the county, the state, and the federal law enforcement officers that wanted the truth on this case to come out. We thank them very much for their effort. We showed that the Murrah building was coming down a full 5 to 8 seconds before the truck bomb even detonated. In the whole scheme of things, Mr. McVeigh's alleged lone truck bomb ordinance was simply an afterthought. It was unbelievable.
And I think it's so vitally important that people see that film, the cover-up in Oklahoma City, but you'll actually see the interviews with the people who were there in the building, and they described the building began to shake as if it were going to come down, and this one man got under the desk before the truck exploded outside, and then the explosion came and it blew in the windows. Now, how could that possibly be? Well, very simply, there were charges in the building and outside, and the government knows that. And they're lying. And if they would lie about killing 168 people in Oklahoma City and got away with it, would they try something even larger and more dramatic? Who in government has been held responsible for the murder of Randy Weaver's wife and his son? Who in government was held responsible for the murder in Waco, where, of course, a special forces team was sent in to kill the women and children there? And if you doubt that, you really need to see the films we have on Waco, where you'll actually hear people who talk to the special forces team that were sent in to carry out the murders. And, you know, you have to understand that we have not gotten the truth about any of this because of the degree of control that exists over the media. But then fast forward 2 years from Waco, to exactly 2 years to the day from the attack on the Waco compound, when the special forces went in to carry out the murders through what happened in Oklahoma City on the 19th of April, 1995. So basically, you have actually, are these any government reports, or how did you get the information, and how solid is the information about those charges on the pillars that brought the Murrah building down?
Well, one has to go no farther than, of course, the report that General Parton, as you're aware, Ben Parton is an expert in the analysis of bomb damage to structures. As I mentioned on an earlier interview, he designed ordnance for the Pentagon for 18 years that would take out hard targets, 2, 3, sometimes 10 times the size of the Murrah building. So if General Parton doesn't know what took that building down, pretty much nobody does. We also have the backing of Sam Cohen, who's a nuclear bomb designer, and quite a few others, one gentleman that worked for the Manhattan Project, and we have ballistics and experts as well as explosive experts from around the country that said, yes, that's exactly where that building was dismantled. And folks that used to work for professional demolition companies, that's their living. They know how to take these buildings apart, and there's telltale damage. So between the blueprints that we studied, the photographs, the video footage, the expert witness testimony, none of this was entered either in the McVeigh or Nichols trial. It was restricted.
And I think people have to understand, Judge Mates, who would have been appointed specifically for that trial, would not allow this information to be brought out in the trial. He allowed $14 million for Stephen Jones, who was the defense attorney, to gather information. And then he wouldn't allow him to present it. Why? Well, somebody obviously had bought pressure because they had to convince the American people why Timothy McVeigh was the lone assassin.
It's amazing. I was reviewing Stephen Jones' writ of mandamus he submitted 3 days before the start of the trial. And it's 167 pages, 160 of which are solid evidence to show that there were at least 9 others involved. And we have 3 in addition to those that were from the local area here, some of who are still living in Oklahoma City, which is absolutely astounding. And between that and the Inspector General's report, the federal prosecution would have had no case whatsoever to show that only McVeigh and Nichols were involved with this. There's no doubt about it. So that's why they don't want the truth to come out, because there's complicity, the prior knowledge, and the fact that where we look at it, 3 stages, either the planning, the commission, or the cover-up of the crime, everybody's equally complicit in it. And we have top leaders of the federal government, Justice Department, that are complicit in the cover-up of this case, and that's absolutely unacceptable.
Well, some people think this was a sting operation of some sort that went wrong. Do you think that's the case, or do you think that that is simply one of the cover stories they're using to confuse the people?
One of the cover stories, it appears to be. There was a deliberate effort to get ordnance inside the building, and to let that happen, and to know that these certain individuals who were being tracked for at least 5 months prior to the case were allowed into the building. Of course, as we reviewed in an earlier show, there was no security in the building. That's a whole other layer of irresponsibility there that needs to be addressed. So the sting operation, I'm not really buying that. A lot of the evidence, all the arrows are pointing in a completely different direction.
And I think that's absolutely right. I think as you begin studying this, you find out that they've laid out all sorts of false stories. We call them rabbit trails. And when you follow a rabbit trail, well, you think you're just about on the rabbit, and suddenly it comes to a blind end, and then you find another rabbit trail. And somebody has to be really very, very clever to lay out all these false stories, and each one designed to distract you away from the truth. Somebody is manipulating our reality. And, of course, we're going to be back in just a moment with Chris Emery, who's there in Oklahoma City now, working with Charles Key and our friend Craig Robertson, and, of course, so many of the other people who are trying to get the truth out about this great tragedy, the forerunner, of course, to 911. Well, this is Dr. Stan, I guess, is Craig Emery. Craig, what part did the Islamic cell, the Iraqi cell in Oklahoma City play? Do you have any idea of what its involvement was? Because we know there was a cell, at least would appear to be a cell, of Iraqi National Guard that were there, Republic Guard. Where does that fit into this whole incredible story?
Some of the people that we have found that were involved with this case were former Iraqi Republican Guard, and they were just part of the... We look at about five layers of individuals here that all had a vested interest in participating in this crime for various reasons. Some were related to the drug smuggling operations into the U.S. from Central America. The Iraqi Republican Guard may or may have not had some revenge aspect in it from the... Saddam Hussein, and even the Iranian aspect of it. We have the Irish Republican Army supplying some alleged parts of the ordnance. This is a very multi-layered, very complicated, and extremely professional job. It wasn't done by two amateurs running on a shoestring budget that had no gainful employment for over 6 years between them.
Somebody had to be financing these two men. I mean, they had to have outside sources of income, and certainly Jennifer McVeigh has presented a letter which she claims was written by her brother Timothy, saying, "I am involved with a special forces team that is involved in illegal activity. Don't tell anybody about this, but I'm involved with a special forces team involved in illegal activity." And certainly there's much to suggest that he tried out for special forces and he never left special forces. He was assigned to appear to be AWOL, and yet he went to work while he's AWOL at a government project, you know, where he had to have some sort of a clearance, and he was being visited by a man named Jocelyn West, a CIA psychiatrist, Jolly West, very well known. Why would Jolly West be coming to see Timothy McVeigh? Have you ever heard that story?
Yes, in fact, he did visit Mr. McVeigh while Tim was incarcerated at the Reno Federal Prison, which is about 22 miles due west of downtown Oklahoma City.
But what about this idea that Timothy was working as part of a special forces undercover team involved in illegal activity? Have you seen that letter that Jennifer wrote, that Timothy wrote to Jennifer?
I haven't seen the letter. I know members of the bombing committee have, and they have checked the veracity out on that. I'm not quite sure of the degree of that. I'm thinking that Mr. McVeigh was involved in some type of special forces capacity, but I'm not quite sure at this point. What we do know that he was actually a very minor part of this case. He was involved. He did deserve to be executed, of course. But the shame about all of this is that the federal government appointed only two individuals, and that's an absolute travesty. That's not the way this case came down, and we have irrefutable evidence to show that.
Now, what about the stories about Terry Nichols going over to the Philippines and spending long periods of time there, supposedly in contact with the Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and Ramzi Youssef and other people who were involved with Al Qaeda. Where does that fit into this whole incredible story, or is that another rabbit trail?
No, it's actually we have information to show that that is true. Mr. Nichols, I believe, got involved in over his head. He didn't realize the severity and the seriousness of what he was doing until it was too late, and he tried to back out. And a very interesting note to his trial in particular was the words of the jury forewoman, Nikki Deutschman, who gave a 47-minute speech.
Hold that thought. We'll be back here in just a moment. Well, Dr. Stan, we've been talking with Chris about several things. One is the fact that Timothy McVeigh had written a letter to his sister, Jennifer, and which he said that he was part of a special forces team involved with illegal activity, and she mustn't say anything about this. She's actually presented this letter. I'm told that she read it at the grand jury hearing. I know that Charles Key has told me he has a copy of that letter. So there's no question it's real. And then, of course, we were talking about Terry Nichols and his involvement, his frequent trips over to the Philippines. Somebody was financing Terry Nichols, an itinerant farmer, works part-time, doesn't have money to take long trips to the Philippines and stay there not once but a number of times. And then, of course, somebody was funding Timothy McVeigh. You don't, have part-time jobs and live well and be able to travel as extensively as he did for 6 years without another source of income. So there's lots of questions here that are simply unanswered. And this is what Chris and the rest of the team that's still working down there are trying to get to the bottom of. So where do you stand right now? How do you begin to put all of these incredible stories together?
What we have to do is just go back to, like I mentioned before the break, to look at the comments of the jury forewoman, Nikki Deutschman, who gave a 47-minute post-trial speech after Nichols was convicted of conspiracy, but he was not convicted of manslaughter. The speech pretty much laid out the fact that the FBI interviewed hundreds of witnesses, had over 3,000 hours of taped interviews, and they failed to present 1 minute of that. They did not convince the jury at all that Nichols is really even partially responsible, other than the fact that it was a minor conspiracy. He was on a minor level. And for the federal prosecutors to expect to get a death sentence out of that that's insane. So they dropped the ball.
Is her testimony available anyplace?
It's actually on tape. I know the Bombing Investigation Committee does have that, I believe, available. We have some masters that we can make copies from if you want to log on to, if you don't mind me plugging the website.
Go right ahead.
www.okcbombing.org. But it's absolutely brilliant what she said after the trial.
Now, why didn't we hear that in the media?
They had the local feed here. In fact, we did get it from the Channel 4, the NBC affiliate, but it was not broadcast beyond, from what we understand, Oklahoma City and the Denver market. And it was cut immediately. There's no way that the national outlets, media outlets, would have touched that. It was very damning to the federal prosecution and the FBI.
But how could they conceal that all across America when we have freedom of the press? And here's the woman who was in charge of the jury that tried Terry Nichols a second time, and she's raising questions about what was presented at the trial.
Sure. She just point blank told them that the FBI dropped the ball on it, and they had the audacity to ask the jury to convict this gentleman of manslaughter and murder when they simply didn't have the evidence to prove it.
Well, they obviously had evidence, but they didn't want to bring it out. It might have raised more questions given the answers.
That's correct. So it was a catch-22, and the prosecution failed miserably at it.
Now, has she had any publicity? I've never heard at all, any mention at all of her or her remarks. And have any of the other people on the jury talked at all about it?
I have not that I'm aware of. I know they... Here's the interesting twist to it all. The first jury that convicted McVeigh of murder and given the death sentence were given a paid round trip to Oklahoma City to view the bomb site. The second jury in the Nichols trial were not even invited to Oklahoma City. So that kind of shows that the public outrage, which was misdirected completely against the jury, was ill-founded. And the jury, rightfully so, in Nichols' case, convicted him of the evidence that was presented before them. And the mirror to that is in Nichols' state trial here last year, and I attended 5 days of that. The other bombing committee members attended various days also, but it was the same verdict. It was pretty much a hung jury, and the judge
Hung jury, you mean that they didn't want to convict him at all, or they did not want to convict him of murder?
They did not want to convict him of murder. And
did they think that he was involved?
Yes, that's correct. And Judge Taylor gave him life without parole, which was parallel to what he received on the federal level.
All right, fine. So now, is anybody trying to get these jurors, especially the one who gave this talk after the second trial of Terry Nichols, to come forward and just repeat what was said?
I believe some folks have approached them. Most of them have left the area. Some have even changed the name, from what I've been told. I have to check the veracity of that. But some of them, they just don't want to deal with it anymore. But the nice thing is that we have Ms. Deutschman's testimony on tape.
Now, on video or on audio tape?
Yes, it's on a videotape.
I see. Is it actually posted on the website, www.okcbombing.com?
.org. I believe we can go ahead and make that available. I'll have a word with Charles tomorrow to see if it is up on the website.
Okay, we'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and of course our guest this evening is Chris Emery, and he is working very hard to try to get the truth about what really happened on April 19th, 1995, that morning when the terrible, terrible bombing at the Oklahoma City Murrah building. But the tragedy is, have we been told the truth? Did the government know the bombing was going to take place and do nothing to stop it? Or was perhaps some contingent of the government was actually involved in this for other purposes? If they were, why? Did they want to see if they could put this over on the American people and get away with it? What was it all about? Looking at best you can at it now, Chris, what do you think it was really all about? It was certainly far more than a lone nut who was trying to, you know, get back at the government for what had happened at Waco. There was a man who was trially trained, a disciplined soldier, who may very well have been acting under orders. He certainly acted like a soldier, his bearing, everything else. In fact, I think it's so amazing as we remember the pictures of Timothy McVeigh coming out of the police station. All of the other prisoners you see today, controversial, they're all wearing a bulletproof vest. But amazingly, they didn't put one on Timothy McVeigh. If you've seen those pictures of him in his orange jumpsuit, it was almost as if they were waiting for a sniper to kill him, like Lee Harvey Oswald. Have you ever thought of that?
I thought that was rather peculiar. He was doing the perp walk out of the Noble County Courthouse, and I often wondered why they had him unprotected, but he was the fall guy. And from what we gathered and his reaction and what he did after the bombing, according to some witnesses, that he knew he was part of the operation, and he didn't think he was going to be caught. But we also found out that he was a occasional user of methamphetamine, so he may have been absolutely hired a kite on some substance at that point. We're not quite sure. We do know when he was in the El Reno prison that he was coming down from those methamphetamines, and his defense counsel said that he was not well at all. In fact, he would have admitted to assassinating Abraham Lincoln. So there was an absolute stew of mind control, using hallucinating drugs. It was a mess. We just, to this day, we still can't figure out what he did and why he was thinking what he was thinking.
All right, fine. Well, I think one of the most interesting parts of this to me, although very, very few people talk about it, is the involvement of the Central Intelligence Agency and a man named Jocelyn, Jolly West, Jocelyn West, Dr. Jocelyn West, was a very well-known CIA mind control doctor who made frequent trips to the jail to see Timothy McVeigh. Now, why would he be visiting Timothy McVeigh? Why would the CIA be so interested? Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we were just conjecturing during the time that we were off, and we were talking about Jocelyn West. Dr. Jocelyn West, if you've read anything about the CIA mind control operations, the name that Jocelyn West, or Jolly West, Dr. Jolly West, comes up time and time again. And I know from a number of sources that I developed through the years that Jolly West was seeing Timothy McVeigh when he was in prison. Jolly West of the CIA. Dr. Jolly West, Jocelyn West, the CIA mind control expert. Now, when you get involved in these very devious programs, why, sometimes it can be very lethal, not only for the patients, but even for the doctors. And my understanding that Dr. Jocelyn West has subsequently expired. But then we shouldn't be surprised. There are over 80 microbiologists, top-notch biologists, who've expired recently in the last few years. And we're going to be doing a program with Steve Quayle on Thursday evening. You'll certainly want to hear that. That will be the second hour of our program. 80 top-notch biologists, biological scientists who work with biological weapons have mysteriously died in the last couple of years. In fact, within the last 2 weeks, the top man in the Soviet Union just happened to be killed in his apartment in Moscow. These are the stories you're not going to hear elsewhere. And then the question comes up, what was the relationship between the CIA and Dr. Jocelyn West and Timothy McVeigh? Do you have any thoughts at all on that, Chris, or what?
I'm not, I haven't studied on Dr. West, but I know that he was absolutely ruthless in his use of mind control and altering drugs and the MK Ultra program. That is an area that I wish I had more time to look at. But you are correct. That's a black ops segment that Mr. McVeigh was definitely involved in to some degree. And obviously anybody in their right mind would not have carried off a crime like this. And according to our eyewitness testimony and the reaction of Mr. McVeigh, along with the three other individuals that he was cited with immediately after the bombing, it was a nonchalant criminal act, and they were just matter-of-fact about it and moved on their way. And his reaction to Trooper Hanger was very calm, very unassuming. One would think that he would have a different frame of mind and mannerism, especially after killing 168 people and being fully conscientious of that, but obviously that wasn't the case. So.
And, of course, the trooper pulled him over. McVeigh had a gun with him.
I mean, yes.
Had I been pulled over by a police officer, and I'd committed that sort of crime, I think that probably anybody would have shot the police officer. He didn't. He didn't try to get away. It was almost as if he was intending to be caught. And here he is. He's wearing all these patriotic T-shirts, and he's got all this right-wing information in his car. If you were going to be involved in this, in a mass attack on the government, would you have all this incriminating evidence in your car? And I've forgotten exactly what the slogan was on his T-shirt, but live free or die or something like that. I mean, it was obviously... It was almost as if somebody had planned to plant all the evidence there. Like there were, it's sort of like Agatha Christie's wonderful story, Murder on the Orient Express. There were just too many clues.
That's correct. In fact, the way we look at it now, we think that there was actually a double team working, that McVeigh did have a stunt double. Because of the way he was sighted and the timing, physically you can't be at two places at once. And that is a viable option that we're still trying to pursue. We've been overwhelmed just with the matter-of-fact story of McVeigh and Nichols by themselves. There were operatives that were brought in that literally were stunt doubles of McVeigh, and that's, like I said, a whole other theory that seems to be pretty viable at this point.
In other words, he was seen at several places at the same time.
That's correct. At least three different places within a three-minute time area. And I've attempted to drive in a normal traffic. I can't even imagine driving a 24-foot panel truck, which... allegedly he was in front of the Murrah building before, and then he departed. Negotiating the traffic here in downtown Oklahoma City would have been impossible within that time frame, especially at 9 o'clock in the morning.
And especially, of course, lighting those fuses. Have you read this book that supposedly he had dictated to the two Buffalo reporters, and he lights the five-minute fuse 5 minutes away, he lights the one-minute fuse 1 minute away, and then he drives up to the front of the building, and just miraculously there's a parking place, and he parks the car, and it takes you 30 seconds to almost a minute to park a truck, and then supposedly he gets out and nonchalantly walks away. That must have been the world's longest minute.
That that book is what is known as a good doorstop. That's what it's worth.
No, I think it's an excellent book because I think it shows obviously that Timothy McVeigh is concocting a story that he knows is not true. And it's almost as like he's saying, was anybody going to be stupid enough to believe that this is true?
That's correct. And one of the authors later admitted that his claims made on the book cover on the inside that he interviewed McVeigh for several hours, he admitted later on in a book signing that that was absolutely false and it was a misrepresentation. So if you get that from the authors, why are you to believe anything inside the book? McVeigh was also documented as being a pathological liar, and that may have been a symptom or a result of the mind control that he was subject to. Most people don't think straight. Obviously, how are you going to keep your story straight? So he was subject to that particular falsehood.
Now, what about this recent revelation by Terry Nichols, who claims that Roger Moore, the man that supposedly they had stolen some gold coins and some rifles from, that Roger Moore had actually supplied part of the explosives, part of the blasting caps that were used to set off the bomb, but that Terry Nichols feels that Roger Moore was a government agent, an agent provocateur, who had actually scouted the buildings, and of course it put Timothy McVeigh up to this. What's your thought on that, or is this another rabbit trail?
No, actually, we've done a lot of research on Roger Moore, alias Bill Miller, and we found out that he had been working for the United States government as early as the Iran-Contra operations. He helped run weapons throughout that operation. So he's been around since the days of Ollie North and Mr. Secord.
Yeah, and, it's so interesting how they use these same people from operation to operation. Kirk Lyons, the attorney who had worked very, very closely with the German agent who was at Elohim City, but also Kirk Lyons had also then representing some of the families at Waco. And now, why would he be representing the families at Waco, in their suits against the government? And then, of course, the next thing we know, why he's working with a man who is obviously a government agent with the Oklahoma City bombing. It's almost like they use these same people over and over again.
They orchestrate it from day one. They know exactly which direction they want this operation to go. They have everybody from the operatives themselves to the lawyers to the judges. It's pretty much an open and shut case.
In fact, I had Kirk Lyons here in my studio on the very evening of the Oklahoma City bombing, and he was here talking. He'd been in our community talking about Waco and how terrible it was, and he was representing the bereaved families there. And then the next thing we know, he's associated with these organizations that seem to be somehow related to the intelligence agencies who are really behind all of these things going on. So, there's so much out there. We just don't know.
That is so true. I would not trust Mr. Lyons' word at this point related to this case. We have no reason to trust him, just like a lot of the top decision makers within the Justice Department. But I do want your listeners to know, and I've acknowledged this in a previous show, that there are a lot of good employees of the law enforcement community from the local, the county, the state, and the federal level that we really owe a lot of thanks and a lot of gratitude towards. They stepped forward and said, hey, this case was not handled correctly. Please take this information and make sure that it gets out and the truth gets out.
And, of course, these men are afraid to come forward and tell the truth. They know what happened to Sergeant Yaki, who, of course, was the first officer on the scene and always believed that, of course, it was a government operation. And he was tortured to death and then subsequently killed. Of course, they called it suicide, but, after he had beaten himself up and then hacked his wrist, then he was shot in the head.
It's
an incredible story, and obviously a police cover-up of a murder of a fellow police officer.
He was 23 years old when he joined the Oklahoma City Police Department. He passed away at the age of 30 years and 6 months. I had the opportunity to visit his gravesite on Memorial Day with one of my production assistants from the film crew. And we try to go out there at least once every 30 or 45 days to pay our respects. Officer Yaki was a stellar officer, one of the best. That was his beat. That was his area he patrolled. He was issuing a traffic ticket at the time of the multiple blasts and ran 4 blocks and was the first officer on the scene of the crime. He pulled out 4 people that we know of and as many as 3 others that still remain nameless. And 1 year and 3 weeks after the bombing, he was murdered, brutally murdered. And you're right, it was posted on a one-page report from the Oklahoma City Police Department as it being a suicide. And that's astounding. There were no crime scene photos, no full autopsy, just a very cursory medical examiner's report signed off by the third in command. Fred Jordan later, after he retired, admitted that Officer Yakey was not suicide, or he did not commit suicide. It was a murder that needs to be continue to be investigated.
But of course, they're not going to investigate it because this goes right up to the governor, Governor Keating of Oklahoma, who just happened to be a very highly placed retired FBI agent. So he is sent down there to become the governor of Oklahoma City to cover up what's really going on, and he did it very effectively. Have you ever read the book that Keating's brother wrote, that almost told long before the Oklahoma City bombing exactly what was going to take place?
I've got it here in my hand, actually, The Final Jihad, and Martin Keating was very crafty on the way he put this book together. The manuscript was actually finished, from what I understand, in 1991. He later came on and other radio shows and rebutted that, but we have proof that the original manuscript was finished actually in late 1991. And he admitted as much on an early interview. There are some more than just coincidences there. The names, the locations, he does twist some of the facts, but this is definitely textbook prior planning and prior knowledge of very devious and very horrific acts of terrorism.
When does he say that, now when does he claim that he wrote the book?
Actually, he claimed that the manuscript wasn't finished until late of 1995 after the bombing, which is absolute baloney. So he was covering his tracks.
Well, of course, they can't let the American people realize that, because think of the implications if the American people realize that they would kill those people. Well, of course, there was one a gentleman, he was a talk show host, his name was Bill Cooper. And Bill Cooper was sort of a sensationalist. Immediately after Timothy McVeigh died, he put on a series of programs where he played a tape over and over and over of a woman who had actually witnessed the death of Timothy McVeigh's execution. And this woman said, "You know, it was the most amazing thing. I didn't know you kept breathing after you were dead." And then he would play that phrase over and over again from this woman who was there. "I didn't know that you kept breathing after you were dead. I didn't know that you kept breathing after you were dead." And about a week after that, why, out comes a SWAT team and killed Bill Cooper.
Oh, my gosh. Mr. Cooper did have some good information. It's unfortunate that he met his demise like that. He was just trying to get the truth out like everybody else.
Right. Well, anyway, I have never bothered to play the tape. I have a copy of it, but I think it might, my life insurance premiums may not be up to date, so I'm not going to play that tape. But there are many people who wonder what really happened. I mean, nobody ever saw the corpse afterwards. It was never, of course, autopsied. The body mysteriously disappeared and has never been seen, wasn't given to the family. Why not? Why not let the family bury their dead? Well, all we know is that the government says that he was simply cremated and buried someplace where nobody would know. Why do something like that? Unless, of course, there's more to the story than we've ever been told. Well, what is your view at all as far as the other information we have that, when they were supposedly going in to rescue the people in there, and suddenly the government suspends all efforts to rescue the people who are trapped, are they going in to get records out? Are they going in to remove other bombs? What's really going on immediately after the first bombing?
The first call-off was to remove live ordnance. There were no training devices that were brought out. They claimed that there were training devices, but there were at least four live ordnance devices that were brought out and hauled away by the Oklahoma County bomb squad.
Well, now, were they other bombs, or were they simply things that shouldn't have been in a building with a lot of people, or do we know what there really were in there that were so explosive they had to get everybody out of the building after the initial bombing?
The first one that we gathered was actually live ordnance. I can't get into the particulars over the phone. There are certain individuals that are asked to keep that in confidence. We will be bringing that on a timely basis. The other items were illegal items stored by the BATF and so forth up on the ninth floor that fell down during the collapse. And, of course, then the third bomb scare was to get the people away at a wider perimeter away from the building. It was a false alarm. What we did find out later on in the evening as the storms were rolling in that the authorities had called off, at least for a four-hour time span, any search and rescue to get the records out that were pertinent to the MENA drug smuggling operation that Bill Clinton was involved with, as well as there were Whitewater records in there, and, of course, federal drug smuggling cases that were pending prosecution. Some of those records are trying to be retrieved. They were hauled to the post office, literally catty-corner to the west of where the Murrah building was. Meanwhile, you have these people that were still alive, fighting for their life, and the FBI agents and federal authorities were stepping over these people and on them through the rubble, trying to get to the records. Evidently, the paperwork was more important than a human body at that time.
Well, now, of course, there were many other, you know, questionable things that were happening. We had heard that there had been some stories about a judge across who had attended a court across the street being told to stay home that day, and other people being told not to, throwing their children into the nursery. Is there any truth to any of those stories?
Yes, Judge Wayne Alley. In fact, the Oregonian, he's from Portland, Oregon, and they interviewed him. He was very candid about it. He said, yes, I was giving information that would not be wise to come into work today. And he was giving, I believe, one week prior notice on that. The ATF did not have their children in the daycare nursery. That is fact. That is not conjecture. That is not rumor. That is fact. We know where the ATF was that day.
Where were they?
Well, we have basically at... There are some buildings, and I'd rather not reveal it over
the phone.
All right,
fine. That's all right.
That's all right. But we finally nailed it, and we know where these people were, what times, who was there, what time they were there. We've got it rock solid.
All right, fine. Are you going to put together some sort of a TV documentary on this?
Yes, that's correct. We expect to release it in due time, and we're very guarded on the information that we have. But you will be one of the first to know, and I can't thank you enough for what you're doing. You're a true patriot, and we really appreciate all of your support.
Well, we appreciate what you and, of course, Representative Key and Craig Roberts and Hoppy Heidelberg and all the others have done to keep this issue alive. Ladies and gentlemen, those people in the Murrah building were killed. Timothy McVeigh was involved, but remember, he had written to his sisters and said, I am part of a secret special forces team involved in illegal activity. Now, if you'd like to see that, that comes, we actually have at least a page out of a book called OK Bomb, written by Jim Keith, who incidentally died mysteriously after a minor surgical procedure, and maybe that was an accident. But within a month or two, his publisher was dead, and then another month or two, his wife was dead. All coincidence? We'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Chris Emery. We've got Roger on the line. Roger, do you have a quick question? We're almost out of time.
I just thought that in the case of William Cooper, he can't blame anybody else for this but him, is that he left too much room for interpretation of suicide by cop. He was kind of pretty fractured the last few weeks there, kind of short and ugly with folks. And then it could just be that was more of a local sheriff thing rather than any, which he had been friendly with prior to that, rather than necessarily some higher ups collaborating that effort. But that's all I wanted to say.
Okay, thanks so much, Roger. Appreciate your call. And certainly we don't know what happened to Bill Cooper, other than the fact he's very dead after playing those rather inflammatory clips, that inflammatory clip over and over and over again. So anyway, we've got about 2 minutes here for you to wrap up the program. What's the message you'd like to leave with our listeners tonight, Chris?
There are a lot of good people in the law enforcement community, once again, that have helped us on this case. Don't lose faith in the United States. It's the higher-ups, the people that are corrupt, that are not holding to the letter of the law that we need to be held accountable. Have held accountable. And I want to end, if you don't mind, with a short prayer that Officer Yeke has on his headstone. And this really inspires me, and as well as a lot of my colleagues, if I may recite it here.
Go right ahead.
It says, Lord, I ask for your courage to face and conquer my own fears, and to have the courage to take me where others will not go. And please, Lord, be at my side. And every time I go out and visit his grave, that's what inspires me to carry on. And don't lose the faith. We have a good country here. There's a lot of good people, and we are very humbled at everybody that's helping on this case. And we know that we're going to get through this and find the truth. And thank you again for all of your support.
Well, I want to thank you, Chris, and I hope you'll be on with us again and keep us abreast of what's going on. And you know, sometimes when you're doing what you're doing, you wonder if anybody out there really listens. But, you know we have thousands of people listening to this program tonight, and thousands of people will hear these audio tapes as we distribute them across the country. So I believe there's a growing awareness, and we know that there are FBI agents who went to my friend Garth Nicholson, and there were others that went to David Shipper before 9-1 and told him there's going to be an attack on Lower Manhattan. They told, of course, Garth Nicholson there's going to be an attack on September 11th on the Pentagon. These were reported to the government, and you know, the most amazing thing is they didn't do anything about it, and were told the government, the FBI knew the attack was coming, but they were sure it was going to be overseas. Do you honestly believe that? And then within 2 hours after the attack, why they were almost at almost all the evidence as to who it was. Thanks so much. Good night. God bless.
Thank you.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and of course we'll be interviewing David Hopsicker within the next week or two. And David has talked to a gentleman who worked at Huffman Education, flight school there in Florida, and he said that within 2 to 3 hours after the 9/11 attack, the FBI was at his door asking questions about Muhammad Atta. Now, we're told the FBI had no idea who these people were. The FBI simply just accidentally stumbled onto all the evidence that Atta had left in a car that was left in the parking lot. But within, according to Daniel Hopsicker, within 2 to 3 hours after the 9/11 attack, according to a man who worked at Huffman Aviation, why the FBI was there questioning him about that. Do you honestly believe the FBI did not know who Muhammad Atta was beforehand? Well, if you believe that is true, why you should read the 9/11 Commission report, staff report we actually have, where they will tell you that they have pictures of Muhammad Atta in January and February of 2001 taking money out of an ATM machine. It was January and February and March of the year 2001, many, many months before the 9/11 attack. How did they get those pictures? Because they only keep the pictures for 6 weeks at the ordinary bank. But, of course, in this instance, why they were managed just to have all of those pictures. Well, we're going to be back here in just a moment or two, find out what some things going on here mechanically, and we'll be right with you here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course, if you'd like to know more about the 9/11, pardon me, about what happened in Oklahoma City, we have a four-tape set. In fact, we have 2 four-tape sets in Oklahoma City. We have 2 videos in Oklahoma City. One is called Oklahoma City Cover-Up in Oklahoma City. The other is a interview with a gentleman who actually had helped to smuggle the explosives in, and had told the FBI about the coming attack. He ended up being put in prison. Why? Because we can't have a man like that out there spreading vicious rumors saying the government knew ahead of time and left those people to die. Could we? Anyway, if you'd like to get either one of the 2 videos, Cover Up in Oklahoma City or the other Oklahoma City video, if you'd like, of course, to get either one of our 4 tape sets, you can get them all together in the Oklahoma City special. Why? Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And then, of course, we hope that many of you will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters, because that's how we're able to do what we do 5 hours a day. And then, of course, we hope that you'll go to our website at radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. You can listen to our internet programs there. 5 hours a day, and you won't get much of anything accomplished, but you'll get a lot of fascinating information as we talk to fascinating people all across America. And I hope that you'll notice the various things we do carry, the Berkey products and the Sanjian radios and of course, the Miracle 2 soap products. But we've got so many books and so many videos and so many 4-tape sets, the information you need to really understand what's going on. And let me suggest that you actually get a copy of my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, because it's impossible to understand anything going on today unless you understand that there are spiritual forces behind everything that's going on today. So if you would like to get the Brotherhood of Darkness, or the video, or the book, or the tape, either available either separately or all together, or the Brotherhood of Darkness special, you must understand we're involved in a spiritual battle for the souls of men and the survival of Western civilization. Again, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. Our website, radioliberty.com. And if you'd like a free copy of one of our newsletters, give us a call. We'll get it for you. And we'll be back in just a moment here for the second hour of Radio Liberty. In just a moment, please pray for America. Pray for revival, but pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. Hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, if you'd like to, call in. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. But I'm going to ask if you'll please hold your calls, because we have with us on the line Andrew Skousen from World Affairs Brief, and we're going to be talking about what's really going on behind the scenes, the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Andrew, thank you so very much for being with us again tonight.
My pleasure, Dr. Stan, as always.
Well, tell us what the major issues are in World Affairs Brief for this week.
All right. Well, we've got a more in-depth analysis about what's going on with Bolivia. There's been a good deal of uprising there, and then we'll try to talk about some Chinese defectors that are causing some slight embarrassment to the Australian government, who is trying to ship them back to China. And then, if we have time after those two, I'd like to touch on a little bit of Iraq, maybe a brief thing about the Watergate scandal, and end up talking about FTAA and CAFTA.
All right, fine. Well, where do we start? With Bolivia?
Yeah, let's start with Bolivia. This is a very interesting story, particularly because it's a very hot spot in the world right now. Bolivia is going through an interesting process, and this process I think would be well to be noted by all of us Americans, because it illustrates the process of what happens when democracy goes unchecked by true principles in a constitutionally limited democracy like we have here in the United States. Many Americans think that the United States is a pure democracy. In fact, it's not. It's a republic which is a constitutionally limited democracy that specifically says that although we vote, we cannot vote ourselves certain things. We cannot vote ourselves certain benefits. We cannot vote away other people's certain fundamental rights. And although, and this form of government is what has given us so much freedom and so much prosperity in our history. But at the same time, as we've noted on this program a fair amount, this concept of having checks and balances in government is constantly being eroded gradually. And so Bolivia is a very interesting case to show and give demonstrations about what happens when there are no checks and balances and what happens when they get completely eroded away. This is a democracy where the people have found that if they cannot vote for something, they can start to become violent for it. And the escalation of violence here is becoming something that's quite scary. They're planning on voting themselves more and more benefits, and we'll examine some of these things here.
All right, fine. Of course, there's tremendous unrest in Bolivia. Bolivia is really almost on the verge of civil war. The whole structure of government is beginning to break down, and we're going to cover that in just a moment here with Andrew Skousen. And of course, there's a Marxist, there's communist guerrillas operating there on one side, and then of course there's the elite who want, of course, keep the people under control, and so you have these forces in conflict, and of course nobody's going to benefit as the country moves from into chaos and crisis. And then dictatorship. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest Andrew Skousen. Pick up the story about Bolivia, Andrew.
All right, well, let me start it with a quote by Bill Cormier of the Associated Press. This is a typical quote from a fairly leftist-leaning reporter. He says, "The crisis in this nation of 8.5 million people pits Indian and labor groups from the poor and western highlands, including La Paz and its poor satellite city of El Alto, against ruling elites from Santa Cruz in the east and the oil-rich gas fields to the south that are pursuing greater autonomy." Now, these kinds of events occur because the peasants in Bolivia have become more and more inflamed about the prospect of possibly taking control of the oil and gas fields. What has happened is that as the raw democracy allows people to vote themselves more and more benefits, there becomes a larger and larger portion of the population who becomes more and more benefit corrupted by the socialist forms of government that is present in Bolivia. And the appetite of benefit-corrupted populaces is much greater than anything that a government taxes and revenue can ever satisfy. And so as they try to make up for this by raising taxes, it becomes more and more oppressive on the economy, and the economy becomes more and more stagnant, resulting in more and more people out of work, more people getting on the government dole, and it's a downward cycle that creates more and more unrest amongst the poor population of society.
But now, of course, aren't many of the people there very unhappy with the way that the proceeds from the oil and gas are being distributed to private corporations, and so they feel that the outsiders and certainly the elite of Bolivia have made a bargain, and they're going to rape and steal all the natural resources of Bolivia, and the rich are going to get richer and the poor are going to remain poor. Isn't that part of what's going on there? And this feeling of resentment at the wealthy class simply exploiting the poor class, and isn't it a matter of sort of class warfare taking place?
It is a matter of class warfare in some instances. The area of La Paz is, no, I'm sorry, of Santa Cruz is the area that's probably the wealthiest part of Bolivia. They've had most of the natural resources and have put them to
hold that thought for just a moment.
Okay.
Well, this is Dr. Stan here, and of course our guest is Andrew Skousen of World Affairs Brief. He's talking about Bolivia, and he's saying that La Paz is the area, of course, where many of the wealthy people live, and many of the natural resources are. Santa Cruz, apparently, is that the capital of Bolivia, do you know?
No, La Paz.
La Paz is, okay.
Is the capital. Santa Cruz is where most of the richer portions of the country's industrialization have taken place. So here I'll talk a little bit about, or I'll quote from someone who's more familiar with this. He says that discussing Bolivia is extremely complex. This by the way comes from Daniel, who left this message on the Plato blog. The internet is a great resource for tying together contacts, and this comes from one of those. He says, discussing Bolivia is extremely complex. Suffice to say for now that the Bolivian Altiplano, long-suffering and long-exploited natives, he calls them, want now to benefit from the oil and gas of the Santa Cruz province, which is the sort of the newcomer and the booming area of Bolivia right now. There was a time where Bolivia fought for the Chaco, which is a very southern portion, in a bloody war with Paraguay. Paraguay won, but no oil was found in the Chaco. And they finally found out that it was just a little bit further north. Meanwhile, Santa Cruz has grown in the recent decades to become the granary of Bolivia and the industrial pole of the country. There's a group in Santa Cruz that would like to create sort of a semi-autonomous area there. They're finding all of the taxes and all of the attempts by the socialist government to pull more and more money from this almost the only productive area of the economy a great drain, and it's causing a stifling effect on all foreign international investment and trade with Bolivia. And so,
my understanding is they're trying to renegotiate the contracts now with the existing people who have oil leases there, which of course is going to discourage any more international investment in Bolivia.
Exactly. No, yeah, that's a very good point. So we have these two areas of Bolivia that are separated by a money distance. The richer portion is in Santa Cruz, and the rest of the country is up in arms about that. And under the influence of Marxist cadres, the poor population, which has more and more been resulting to violent protests, has been instigated by the Marxist groups who are attempting to use this level of unrest to cause a coup on the democratic government there and put a Marxist leader into power. This has had a very interesting effect, because when it's difficult to continue a revolution when it's making the economy stagnant and it's paralyzing the country in and of itself. It takes a certain amount of bloodshed to incite more people to feel that they need to join these revolutionary bands. So the Marxist cadres are intent on trying to get the protests to become more and more violent and to provoke reactions from the police and the military. Because of this, and also because of the unfavorable reporting that the leftist media has given to any reaction of force by the government, the country has become more and more paralyzed now. Food is starting to run out. There's almost no more fuel for auto from Mobile's protesters are infiltrating the oil fields and keeping the equipment from running to keep them from exporting to the United States, and it's shutting the entire country down.
Well, of course, what this whole thing is intention to create chaos, but nobody ever asks, where is the money coming to finance this thing? Who's putting up the money for the Marxist movement? And of course, we only need to study geopolitics to find out that most of the money that finances communism in every country, whether it be communist China, as we are financing it today, or in communist Russia, and you go back to 1918, where the funding for the communists came directly from the United States and Great Britain, where did the money come to finance the Cuban Revolution? Came from the United States. And those of you who haven't read the book, The Fourth Floor, or seen our talk on the fall of Cuba, will find out that the CIA instigated bringing Fidel Castro to power. Could we be doing something similar in Bolivia? Because it really doesn't make any sense. Why would we want Marxists in power there? But then why did we install a Marxist regime in Zimbabwe, which used to be Rhodesia, where there's such terrible suffering and tragedy there today? Is literally millions of people have had their homes destroyed, and millions of people are starving in Rhodesia with the government we brought to power. Why would we do something like that in Zimbabwe? Why would we be doing that in Bolivia? Why would we, under any circumstances, would the CIA finance communist movements, not only there, but throughout the world? So, and of course, most people would think the money would be coming from Russia. Some of it is, and maybe some of it's coming from communist China. But then, who's providing all the funds for Russia and communist China today? So what's your take on what's going on there? Obviously, the country's moving into civil war. It's moving into strife. But, you know, it really doesn't make any sense. And yet we've seen this pattern carried out over and over and over again. And the people either can side with America and be exploited, or they can side with the communists and be exploited. That doesn't give the average individual much of any choice, does it?
It's true. In fact, many of the poor population is resulting to growing coca leaves and helping out the drug trade. The black market is becoming one of the only viable solutions for people to make any kind of living, and consequently, it's helping out the drug trade, which is run by the Marxist cadres. And so the Marxists are becoming more and more are receiving more and more money through that avenue as well. And Venezuela's Marxist president, Hugo Chavez, has also been funneling money toward these Marxist groups to try to encourage this as well. But I think that you're probably right, Dr. Stan. If history is any indication, I'm sure that the United States itself is also responsible for many of the Marxist cadres and their power because of the amount of funds given to them.
And of course, the people there are simply victims. Which side are they going to be on? And neither side. The trouble is that neither side is good.
That's right. That's right. So it's a difficult situation, and many of the politicians there don't want to take the credit or the flack, better yet said, for this situation. Many of the politicians have attempted to resign. The Bolivian president Carlos Mesa finally did succeed in resigning. He attempted to before, and Congress stopped him from resigning in an attempt to keep him there and keep some kind of stability in the country.
My understanding is that the Congress really is hiding. They have an army around them to try to defend them from the mobs which are trying to get to them. Is that true?
That's right. Due to the unrest in the capital, in fact, the Bolivian Congress had to be flown out, and they were flown out to the city of Sucre, which was set up to receive them for an emergency session. But mobs started streaming toward that city as well in order to pursue their prey, and they they pulled out 2,000 armed forces to protect this emergency session of Congress there. And basically the whole purpose of the emergency session was to decide whether or not to accept Mesa's resignation.
That's so incredible. This is so similar to what happened in Russia back in 1917, where the members of the Russian Duma were living in constant terror as they heard the mob surging around them, and they just felt this evil that was surrounding them, and they knew that their country was going to be destroyed. And fast forward now, almost 90 years. 80-some years, and we see the same thing happening in Bolivia today, where the members, the duly elected members of Congress, are living in fear of the mobs, simply grabbing them and tearing them apart.
It's true.
They are living in constant fear down there. And this is, of course, what our policies have wrought.
That's right. And one of the violent incidents resulted in a miner being shot in a clash with police, and that has since created a much larger surge of violent protest there, which seems to be exactly what the Marxist cadres want. It's galvanizing the opposition against the government and force there.
And of course, what they do is they create a chaos so that they can, and crisis so that they can restore order. And when comes the restoration of order? And all freedom is lost. That's how communists come to power. That's what's going on in Nepal today, as we're doing everything we can to undercut the king and the legitimate form of government, demanding, of course, you give democracy there. When you're in the middle of a war with Maoist terrorists there in Nepal, same thing's happening in Bolivia. It's happening in countries all over the world. But the average American can't see how this is an example of the dialectic where the ultimate was loss of all freedom. Well, Dr. Stan, our guest is Andrew Skousen. We're talking about what's going on in Bolivia. So what else should we bring out about Bolivia?
Well, I just like to talk about what happened when the president resigned. What good did it really accomplish? Well, none at all. All it did was exacerbate, because it showed a sign of weakness by the government. Mesa, who was the government of Bolivia who resigned, wasn't willing to take the heat for enforcing the law. And now La Paz, the capital, is becoming a dying city. The next person in line is the Senate president. His name is Ormando Vaca Diaz, who most likely will not be able to satisfy the mobs. He actually comes from the oil and gas region and is a big landholder there, which are both, of course, very negative things in the eyes of the people he is trying to placate. But it's gotten to the point where the mobs aren't going to listen to any elected leader. The only person that the mobs will probably listen to right now is Evo Morales. And Morales is the Marxist, is the leader of the Marxist cadres, who is attempting to gain power there. If he does come to power, the result, I think, will be a complete revamping of the country. They will nationalize both the gas and the oil industry, which is already happening. And let me illustrate it with a quote. This is by Sacha Lorenti, who's the leftist president of Bolivia's Assembly on Human Rights. He says, Bolivia is in a complete and profound crisis, not just a crisis of this moment, but a structural crisis. He says, we're at the point of defining what model of accumulation of wealth we're going to use and what model of redistribution of wealth we're going to use. Now, notice that he said what model of redistribution, not if there's going to be redistribution. The Marxist model would, of course, nationalizing all the major sources of revenue, which would stifle production and lead to even larger masses of benefit corrupted peasants. I think the final lesson we can take from this bad. Benefit corruption knows no limits. Bolivia is a classic study in the violent manipulation of ignorant peasants in order to bring down a nation and then turn it over to Marxist revolutionaries, who, by the way, will never be able to deliver on the promises of prosperity through benefits to the general public.
And what people really don't understand is when you have a Marxist establishment, you basically have a ruling class, and you just established that you replaced one ruling class with another ruling class, and then everybody is impoverished, everybody else is impoverished. This is how it always works. Communism has nothing to do with redistributing the wealth. It has to do with making a new ruling class. That's what it's about.
That's right. Historically, whenever government takes more power illegitimately from the rest of the citizens, it ends up being corrupted by that power and granting certain favors to specific groups and allowing certain people to gain wealth and
hold
prosperity.
That thought right there, please.
Yeah.
Well, Dr. Stan, our guest is Andrew Scouse, and he's just saying what the tragic situation it is in Bolivia today. As, of course, we're moving towards the establishment there, probably of a Marxist society, and we have to understand Marxism is a sincere, benevolent, idealistic theory, but it doesn't work without force. Somebody has to be in control, otherwise you have anarchy. And the true purpose of all Marxism, contrary to what you learn in school and what we teach in our colleges, is the establishment of a new ruling class. That is the communist class. And then everybody else is impoverished and oppressed. And anybody who gets out of line, of course, is either executed or imprisoned or tortured. That is the way a communist system works. And so, in the name of trying to rectify the injustice that they see in contemporary society, why you mobilize the masses with the help of the media and planned agitators, you overthrow the existing structure, and then you create a new ruling class with far more poverty for the people than ever before. But the average Indian and the average poor person who's involved has no idea of history and doesn't realize that they are being manipulated to destroy any opportunity they have for improvement or for freedom and to bring them under the boot heel of an authoritarian communist society. That's really where Bolivia is going right now, isn't it?
That's right. And if Bolivia can in the way that they're going, well, I think we'll see in a couple of years a pretty significant form of communism there.
Right.
And I'm afraid the people will then find out only too late that the communists won't be able to overthrow the communist leaders like they have been able to overthrow the democratic government. Communists don't hesitate to use force to stay in power. And if they are overthrown, it will only be by a well-financed globalist type force, which, as we've seen, only institutes a more deceptive form of control.
And what a tragedy it is. But, of course, it's like deja vu all over again. We've seen it happen time and again throughout the world.
That's true, Dr. Stan. Well, let's move on.
All right.
Shall we?
Where are we going next?
I'd like to comment on the interesting case of the Chinese defectors who have recently surfaced in Australia. What has been happening is that most people who follow Chinese politics know that the Chinese government is very careful not to allow defectors and prosecute any that they find very rigorously. Consequently, there haven't been very many communist defectors. We found one who surfaced recently in Australia, and he started to become a little too vociferous and created a little bit of stir and embarrassment with the Australian government. And since he came out, several other defectors have appeared as well who seem to be incurred by the fact that one of them seems to be catching a little bit of limelight and not being deported back to China.
But of course, the Australian government's trying to send them back to China, because you have to understand the Australian government, just like the American government, pays lip service to being anti-communist, but really is not. But what this Chinese communist defector is telling, and has come out publicly and said, is there's a whole network of Chinese spies all throughout Australia. And the Australian government's doing everything they can to silence him. And now somebody else has come out, another Chinese that's defected from the embassy, and said, yes, there is this network. It's all over Australia. Don't you understand? And now what's the Australian government going to do? Are they going to send these people back and have the Australian people understand that their government is working hand in glove with the communists there in communist China? Boy, that would be a terrible thing. People might begin to understand that communism has constantly been helped and financed by the West. So what's going to happen over there to these defectors?
Well, very interesting case. Let's talk specifically about Chen Zhonglin, who was one of the defectors, or is one of the defectors. And he revealed during a spoken rally that marked the anniversary of the Tiananmen Square revolt. He said, quote, "They have successfully been kidnapping people in Australia back to China." He also said that Australian officials told him to his face that they don't want him in the country and do not care about his revelations. These remarks are causing a firestorm among the so-called conservative government there in Australia, headed by Prime Minister Ron Howard.
And, of course, there is a communist network here in the United States. And, in fact, if you read some of the books written by Stephen Moser's, Chinese living in this country are constantly followed by Chinese intelligence agents, and their homes are watched. And they report it to the government, the FBI, and they do absolutely nothing about it. And one of the women was pregnant, wanted to have a child here. She was told she couldn't, and she was going to have to come back again. And our government did everything they could to help the Chinese communists control the Chinese here. Well, Dr. Stan, back here at Radio Liberty, our guest is Andrew Skousen. Go ahead, Andrew. I mean, this is, I think, is so much the way things really work, and you would think that maybe the people of Australia or the people here in the United States might begin to get the picture. All this so-called struggle between communism and capitalism is really more or less designed for the public consumption. After all, we have to have a mighty military to fight the communists, and yet we're constantly financing and helping the communists. Why would we do something like that?
That's right. This story that we're covering right now actually brings to light a lot of the collusion that is obvious, or makes it obvious, between the so-called conservative government around the world and the communist Chinese. We're talking about Chen Zhonglin, who is a Chinese defector who tried to defect in Australia. This particular fellow is 37 years old, and he noticed, as soon as he made his first contact with Australian officials, that the Australian officials had tipped off his Chinese bosses, despite his making numerous assertions right up front that he would be in grave danger if he were to be forced to return home. And yet Australian authorities refused his asylum request within 24 hours without even interviewing him. They repeatedly urged him to return to the Chinese consulate in Sydney. Now, this Chen Zhonglin had been the first secretary at the Chinese consulate in Sydney, and he defected because he had extensive knowledge about Chinese persecution of dissident groups in China. Particularly with respect to the Falun Gong movement, which, as many people know, is a religious group there that focuses on meditation. And this movement has been particularly attacked by the Chinese government, and they have tried to extinguish it completely on the Chinese continent. Many of the members of this group have tried to flee to other parts of the world. There's a number of them here in the United States as well. Do you know much about the the Falun Gong?
Well, I don't know a great deal about it. It gets a lot into sort of exercise, and as you say, in the meditation, right. And it is really a sort of a religion in many respects. But of course, it tends to draw people away from their subservience to communism, and the communists object to anything that detracts people from total dedication to the Marxist dream of the New World Order. We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here in Radio Liberty. We were talking about this Falun Gong group there in communist China, which, of course, has been severely restricted and persecuted by the Chinese communist government. It is a religion. It is a philosophy. It is really almost like a New Age movement. Every effort has been made to suppress it in China, and of course to suppress the involvement of Chinese in this movement in other parts of the world. And I think that this is one of the things that there are a lot of Chinese who have immigrated to into Australia. My understanding is that the Chinese communists, of course, keeps track of every Chinese citizen anywhere in the world. Whether they're in Australia, whether they're here in the United States, they're all tracked by the communist cadre stationed here in the United States, and they're bringing them in all the time, large numbers of them. And even if they want to be free, if they want to become members of our society, why, they know that the communists will kill or torture their families at home, and that they are being watched all the time they're here. And if they get a government job, they are told that they must spy, or there'll be retaliation against them and their families. And, of course, we are doing nothing to stop this network of subversion right here in our own country. What? The government is not tracking the communist subversives and the communist agents here. They're looking after conservative, anti-communist people. And they point our attention to the real danger of patriots, but not of the communist network across America.
That's right. And some of the mistreatment of the Falun Gong movement people has been witnessed by people, in particular Chen Yonglin, who has recently tried to defect in Australia, and because he started to make a little bit of a row, and the press started to pick up on his story. For instance, the South African news service is quoted as saying, opposition politicians and trade unionists accuse the government of Australia of putting trade ties ahead of human rights by refusing to consider asylum for Chen, the highest profile Chinese defector in Australia. After Chen went public with this and started gaining media attention and press, and the Australian government started to back down and reconsider because of the embarrassment, a couple of other people came forward as well.
Now, these are a couple of other Chinese, and of course, they're secret agents for China, and now they're coming forward and telling the Australian people and verifying what the first man has said.
That's right. One of them was Hao Fenjun, who was one of the Chinese who was helping to run a spy outfit called the Secret Force, which, as you were talking about, helps to keep track of the Chinese in Australia and New Zealand and other Western countries, as well as spy. He said that there are three levels of agents working for the Secret Force. He called them professional spies who graduate from police college and are paid to travel overseas to collect intelligence. Working relationships with agents who act as businessmen, who target business groups abroad, people that they call friends, to infiltrate foreign countries and become friends of Chinese and Westerners. So these three groups, working relationship agents, friends, and businessmen, target various aspects of the country to get information about them for the Chinese. And all of this is part of the Secret Force. While the Secret Force's targets included political and military information, it also monitored the activities of the Falun Gong and other religious or Chinese pro-democracy groups. Hao even copied some documents from his police computer and gave samples of them to the Australian immigration officials as proof of what he was saying. And recently, a third defector has also been granted asylum. He's gotten a lawyer who said on Thursday that this the this man said that he claims he witnessed state security agents beat a man to death in his police station, and because of this, this attempt to gain asylum apparently was granted the protection visa by Australia. So the Australian government is trying to curb this now. It's not giving out more names. It's trying to allow this episode to blow over, and it's trying to take away the amount of news coverage that this is gaining, because it is encouraging more and more defectors to take courage and to defect.
And, of course, if they're sent back, you can be sure, of course, they'll be tortured and imprisoned. But then why should we be surprised when people try to escape from Cuba today? And there was a case just this last week, 10 days, where people are trying to escape from Cuba in a car, and they had pontoons on it. And of course, they were picked up by the Coast Guard, and the majority of them were sent back. I've forgotten how many there were, but a couple of them were allowed to stay, but the majority of them were sent back to Cuba. Why? Because they were very, very... One of them was a doctor, and, the Cubans need doctors, so we certainly wouldn't want a doctor to defect, and some of the people who are willing to risk their lives to get away from Cuba, and we send them back to be imprisoned and tortured. Why would we do that? For the same reason the Australian government would, to try to send the Chinese back. This myth of the conflict between communism and capitalism is as phony as a $3 bill. But after all, if we didn't have that threat of communism or terrorism or something else, would we be willing to give up our freedom to government to protect us and preserve our freedom?
That's right. That's exactly right. And these countries, these Western countries, are continuing to kowtow to Beijing and its wishes, even with people with significant information like these defectors.
And, of course, within Australia, you have your Royal Institute of International Affairs. In New Zealand, your New Zealand Institute. In Canada, your Canadian Institute. In South Africa, your South African Institute of International Affairs. They all tie under the Royal Institute in London, which, of course, has a parallel organization in New York City at 58 East 58th Street. It's called the Council on Foreign Relations.
That's right. That's right. All right, well, that's the information about this that I wanted to cover. Shall we move on to some of the other stories in this week?
Let's go right ahead.
All right, well, let me take a little bit of time to tell our listeners about how they can find out more of this information about the brief.
You tell them how they can find out about the World Affairs Brief and get the material you have, which is so well-organized and so informative.
Yes. Well, let me first explain that there's sort of two levels of information that we offer here at the World Affairs Brief. The first level is free. We operate a website at www.worldaffairsbrief.com where we go through with several other researchers and cull through the news throughout the internet and through and everywhere where we think is real true information that is out there to supplement the limited information that we get through the major media sources. We realize that most people don't have time to go through and research all of these websites that we go through, and so we provide a synopsis of what we think are the most important stories. And we post links to the short description of what they are on www.worldaffairsbrief.com. We also, for those people who would like a more in-depth analysis of the news, we offer a second level of information to people. And this is through the World Affairs Brief itself. This is an analysis of the news done by our group where we actually try to track trends and where the country is moving and where other countries throughout the world are moving, as well as what's happening economically and politically. And you can sign up for this weekly email edition or for a monthly snail mail edition of it by calling toll-free area code, calling toll-free 1-877-518-5888. That's toll-free 1-877-518-5888. And if you'd like just to try out a complimentary copy of the brief, feel free to call this number and you can get a free copy of the brief in the mail and decide whether or not it's something that you would like to look into. And if you're on our website, there are also links to sign up for this. So I think that information in today's world is one of the most important aspects that we have, and I think that what we offer people here is something that's very useful and helpful.
I do too, and I go to your website every morning that I possibly can and pull down all those articles. Don't pull them all down, but I certainly scan them, and then there's always a few that are fascinating, including the Australian story and the Bolivian story and the stories we've talked about tonight.
That's right. And then the in-depth analysis that's provided by people like my father, who has a great deal of expertise in filtering through news and seeing things that are sometimes difficult to see with the way that news is presented, is particularly helpful, I think.
I think it really is. I always enjoy your father's commentary.
Yeah.
All right, Father, well, what's the next subject we're going to go to?
Well, let's talk about one of those issues. Let's talk about Iraq and what the possibilities might be of the United States attacking Iran next.
All right, fine. Well, everything that we see seems to be suggesting, that they're building up our preparation for Iran. We're being told Iran's getting ready to attack us. Iran is going to explode a missile over the United States and destroy our electronic infrastructure. And Iran is going to attack Israel. And Iran is going to attack Iraq and attack our troops there. And, well, my goodness, we're going to have to do something before Iran attacks us, aren't we? And these are all plant articles. People have to understand they plant these articles. They have people planted in the media to generate a psychology so the American people will be willing to expand the war and kill more Americans and kill more Iranians. So what's your take on what's going on, Andrew?
Well, it's sort of a difficult situation to decipher, really, because, like you say, it's pretty clear that Iran is in the gun sights of the Bush neoconservative team. But many of the Bush administration officials have privately talked about being worried that Iran may not be a good next target. And for fairly good reason, according to some of the Asia Times analysis, Iran isn't going to be as much of a pushover as Iraq was. They say that it's armed with a vast array of anti-ship and long-range missiles. Iran can target U.S. troop positions throughout the Middle East and strike U.S. Navy ships. Iran can also use its weapons to blockade the Straits of Hormuz, through which one-third of the world's traded oil is shipped. With the help of both Beijing and Moscow, Tehran is becoming an increasingly unappealing military target for the U.S. And yet, we still see that the U.S. is bent on pulling off some kind of at least limited attack on Iran. Iran's nuclear program is only a few years away from actually having a nuclear weapon, and its intermediate-range ballistic missile program is in full bloom right now. Iran has already successfully tested its first series of solid-fuel rockets, which, I might add, have numerous advantages over the liquid-fueled Soviet-era Scud missiles that we saw used so often in Iraq. The difference here is that the Scuds had to first be loaded with fuel while they were in the field, and if they weren't used, they had to be quickly drained of the fuel and downloaded. Whereas the solid fuel rockets can be built and shipped to any of many secret launch locations, and they're all ready to go. And Russian, Chinese, and North Korean advisors are all working in large numbers, as the U.S. well knows, to help Iran's Shahab-3 rocket program.
And of course, we go to war with Iran. Why, they have actually treaties with both Russia,
yeah,
and with India and with Pakistan and with
China,
and we're planning on building an oil pipeline from Iran across Pakistan to India. We're going to antagonize everybody in the world if we go to war with Iran. And yet, it's very obvious. This is what the ultimate plan is. If you don't believe it, you should get hold of William Crystal's interview with Ted Koppel. We actually have copies of that, at least the script of that, where, of course, it was very obvious exactly what was intended. We are going to war with Iran. This is the long-range plan. The reason we went in to take Iraq first was because we'd been bombing it for 10 years. They had no army. They had no resistance. There was no way that we could they could effectively resist us, and they were simply a pushover. We were in Baghdad within a week of the attack. But it's not going to be the same thing with Iran. And we knew that. We had to have a base in preparation for the plan of the attack on Iran. And, of course, what's even worse is we brought the Ayatollahs to power. We toppled the Shah of Iran in 1979 and installed the Ayatollahs. And I've often said, in 1979, I didn't understand why we destroyed a friend and installed an enemy. Today, it's very obvious. We've created the best enemy that American foreign policy could create. So what's going to happen next?
Yeah, no, that's a very interesting analysis, Dr. Stan. I think that with the world today trying to decipher what the purpose of politics is, I think the really only true conclusion that we can solve is what the result is that we're seeing right now. And I think that the result that is happening now is actually one of the purposes, and that is to create antagonist feelings among other nations towards the United States.
And we're sure doing a good job to antagonize the whole of the rest of the world.
That's right. Well, here at the World Affairs Brief, our assessment and tentative prediction is that the U.S. will launch a limited strike on Iran's nuclear program later this year or early in 2006. And as with the strike on Iraq's reactor, they will probably try to contain the damage and not widen the war, because Iran's not going to be a pushover, and the U.S. won't be able to pull it off without a huge mobilization of manpower, and that would probably mean a draft. But, you know, they're probably definitely going to do a limited strike.
All right, fine. Well, I certainly agree with you. We have Tim on the line from Indiana. We're going to get to Tim in just a moment here, but to wrap up the program right here at Radio Liberty. News is staying right on there. Well, Dr. Stan, Andrew's our guest, and we have Tim calling from Indiana. Tim, did you have a question for our guest?
Oh, yes. Hi, Andrew. Andrew,
hi, Tim.
You and your brother and your dad, you guys are excellent. And
thank
it
you.
Does look like Iran is in the crosshairs here of the Bush administration and the rest of them, Halliburton. I mean, why would you drop bombs on areas that possibly might have nuclear sites? But I want to ask a quick question here, and I'll hang up. It's time for the mind conditioning on the Aruba kidnapping. We go from one diversion, the Michael Jackson, right into the Aruba. This was orchestrated by the CIA. We know that the CIA kidnapped children and women for sex purposes, Kathy O'Brien's book, Transformation of America. So do you think this could be possibly a CIA kidnapping? Thank you.
All right, fine. Thank you. Well, what are your thoughts on that?
I'm not sure. I'm not familiar yet with the Aruba kidnapping, I'm sorry to say.
And so I think that the fact to make any sort of a speculation on that without some solid evidence one way or the other would be sort of irresponsible. So that I think that you're better off with just saying no comment, because we really don't know.
Look, yeah, I'll have to look that up.
All right, well, why don't you go ahead, and we've got about a minute and a half to wrap up the program this evening.
All right, well, let's just touch a little bit. We, in the rest of the stories in the World Affairs Brief that people can receive, talk about the Watergate takedown of Richard Nixon. We have a story in there that talks about some very interesting information that was brought to light by Gary North, who quotes Susan Huck, who presents a very interesting argument for collusion within the White House to help out Mr. Felt, who, as we recently found out, was the one who leaked a lot of information, but he had a little bit too good of information.
In other words, he had to have other informants giving him information.
Yeah, and not only just informants, but somebody deep within the White House itself.
I still think it was Henry Kissinger.
Yes, that's a very good...
And Alexander Haig, the man who had the tapes, you know, and wouldn't give Richard the tapes, Richard Nixon the tapes so he could destroy them. So, and of course, Haig was Kissinger's man, so they all worked into this together. They were all CFR people, all part of this ruling elite that rules the country. And they were intent to get Nixon.
It's true. Tell me how much more time do
we
have?
About 20 seconds.
All right, well, I'd just like to say that there's a... quick quote from Representative Ron Paul, who's a Republican from Texas, a senator, talks about NAFTA, and just one point to leave our listeners with is that he says...
Hold that thought as soon as we get to the music.
Okay,
this is Dr. Stan, and we're going to get a quotation from Representative Ron Paul. What was it?
Yes, he's talking about the free trade areas of the Americas, FTAA and CAFTA, and he says, "We don't need government agreements to have free trade. We merely need to lower or eliminate taxes on the American people without regard to what other nations do. Tariffs are taxes on consumers. Once we alleviate these taxes, then the free trade will take care of itself. We don't have to give up our government sovereignty to other governing bodies around the globe in order to have free trade."
I think that's an excellent point.
And then, I agree.
And basically what all of these are, the World Trade Organization, NAFTA, CAFTA, they're all about supranational organizations bringing us under control. It was all laid out as part of a plan laid out by Richard Gardner in April of 1974 in Foreign Affairs magazine. We talked about doing an end run around the Constitution using GATT and the World Trade Organization, the Law of the Land of the Sea Treaty, to bring us under international control. This is long-range planning. These are very wealthy and powerful people who hate America and who hate freedom, dedicated to the New World Order, the New World Religion. Andrew Skousen, thanks very much for being with us, and I hope we can have you on again next week.
My pleasure, Dr. Stan. I look forward to it.
Good night. God bless.
Good night.
Okay, fine. Well, that was Andrew Skousen. Always a pleasure. And, of course, the information that comes from World Affairs Brief is excellent. We recommend it to you. And then, of course, we certainly want to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported. And if you believe in what we're doing, you'd like to see us continue doing it or even expanding what we're doing and taking on new audiences, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And consider joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters or perhaps subscribing to the newsletter. Or if you'd like a free copy of the newsletter, give us a call. We'll send you our April newsletter, which is the expose of the Federal Drug Administration and their collusion with the drug industry to release drugs that they knew were going to kill tens of thousands of Americans. An amazing, amazing story. It's basically Dr. David Graham's testimony before the Senate last year. Testimony that, although you may have read a little bit about it, the real truth has been carefully concealed by the controlled media. If you'd like to know how the media is controlled, let me suggest the book, The New Media Monopoly by Professor Ben Bekdakian. We do carry that book. If you'd like to know how the CIA controls people's minds, the book Operation Bluebird by Dr. Colin Ross, who has taken care of literally dozens, if not hundreds, of victims of CIA mind control operations. That's Operation Bluebird, an amazing, amazing story. And you can hear my interview with Dr. Colin Ross, the author, in our four-tape set, Operation Paperclip, going into how the CIA brought Nazis to the United States after the Second World War, Nazi war criminals, many of them to continue their activities in mind control, which have been continued right here because, you see, our leaders have always worked very closely with the Nazis. They didn't want the American people to know that. They certainly didn't want them to know about the rat line where the United States helped 10,000 of the most vicious Nazi war criminals escaped to South America, and the OSS and the CIA worked in concert with other intelligence organizations from the Vatican and from Great Britain to help the Nazis escape. Dr. Mengele, Morton Bormann, Adolf Eichmann, Klaus Barbie all got to South America. An amazing, amazing story, which you're never going to hear elsewhere. Operation Paperclip, available by calling 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And then, of course, we hope that you'll certainly want to get my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, which will give you insight into the spiritual forces behind what's going on today. Because we truly are involved in a spiritual battle for the souls of men and the survival of Western civilization. So, well, remember our number, 1-800-544-8927. Our website, radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. You can listen to our programs there 5 hours a day on the Internet. Pray for America. Pray for revival. Please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. Until tomorrow at the same time, may the Lord be with you.